This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, High and Dry in Ethiopia, a lake turns to land.
It's sad. It's very sad. I never thought this lake was going to be gone because it was a natural thing, you know?
And touche. Poor kids in New York thrust and parry their way to a better life.
You know, I walk through the streets of Harlem and, you know, to everybody else, I'm just another guy, you know, and that's cool with me. When I come here, I'm something more. You know, I'm not just a guy from Harlem. I'm a fencer. I'm an Olympian.
Plus, more from Myanmar after the devastating cyclone. Welcome to the World Vision Report. Chala Ahmed had a dream. He wanted to build a waterfront home for his family on the shores of Lake Haramaya in eastern Ethiopia. But now that's impossible. The lake has dried up. Lakes around the world are shrinking. Some attribute this to climate change. Others believe water mismanagement is at the root of the problem. Whatever the cause, the shrinking water supply is affecting communities all across the globe. Jessica Partnow brings us this story from Ethiopia.
Chala Ahmed should be standing under 25 feet of water. Instead, he's in the middle of a pale, grassy field.
I came out in here at night. In the morning, I just wake up the first time. Then I went outside and see, and then I start crying, you know.
Young children are herding sheep and goats around him as he shades his eyes from the afternoon sun. Ahmed had a dream to build a lakefront home for his family here. The 26-year-old has been working in Minnesota, driving a long-haul truck and saving up to build the house. This is his first visit home in 8 years.
Even right now, for me, when I walk on this lake, I mean, I get emotion, you know, when I remember every little thing I used to do in this lake, you know.
Friends had told him the lake was drying up, but it was hard to believe that a 9-mile stretch of water that had been there all his life could disappear.
It's sad. It's very sad. I never thought this lake was going to be gone because it was a natural thing, you know?
For Ahmed, the water's disappearance came as a sudden shock. But for people living around Lake Haramaya, as it shrank, it was a horrifying decades-long process. Lake Haramaya is a closed water catchment fed only by rainfall, and the amount of water taken out simply overwhelmed the amount going in. Here, farmers frantically dig deeper and deeper into the mud in search of water for their crops. There's still water under the ground here, and in the rainy season, a puddle sometimes forms in the center of the lake. But right now, still months away from rain, the farmers must dig up to 22 feet into the earth before they hit water. Ahmed Dawid's family has been farming the land around Lake Haramaya for generations.
We spend a week digging a well like this one. Then we can go work on our farms for 2 or 3 days.
Like Dawid, many farmers here grow chaat, a mild stimulant popular in the region. Over the past decade, farmers have used irrigation to push the thirsty, deep-rooted shrub to produce 3 or 4 harvests a year. In the dry season, a single kilo can bring 1,000 Ethiopian birr, or more than $100, 10 times the rainy season rate. Dawid says the economic incentive to irrigate is intense.
Now we put all our energy into digging for water. We don't have enough time to tend our crops. We can't grow as much as we used to.
Dawid can see the water he's pumping from the lake bed won't last long. He's sending his 4 children to school in hopes they'll find work other than farming. He laughs when I ask him what will happen when the water goes.
What can we do? We have to follow the will of God.
Farmers have been blamed for what happened to the lake, but others share in the responsibility. A brewery used lake water to make beer, and the city of Harar used Haramaya as its primary source of drinking water. Climate change has only made things worse. The past 2 decades have seen rising temperatures, which lead to more evaporation and increasingly erratic rains.
You know the level of the water.
Okay, it's like a big yardstick that goes up to the top.
This is simply an indication of how much it is inside. Mm-hmm. So we do have 3.
Bushara Rashid is head of public relations for the Harar Water Supply. We're looking at the city's 20,000-gallon reservoir, a squat cylindrical tank sitting in the hollow of land that used to be the lake's northern curve. The water comes from boreholes dug into the former lake bed, powered uphill by a humming generator. The system was constructed once it became clear that the lake was going to dry up completely, but it wasn't finished in time.
During the emergency, no school. School was closed. Even there is no water for hand washing.
The emergency started on February 10, 2004, when the pumps bringing lake water to the city of Harar were turned off for the last time. International aid groups sent in water trucks to help the 91,000 who were left without running water. Before the crisis, Rashid had lobbied the government to restrict lake water usage, but the regional and national water ministries each claimed the other was responsible.
So during that emergency period, we voiced or screamed that please declare state of emergency.
The town eventually connected its 100-year-old pipes to the hastily dug boreholes, bringing water back to the city. Hydrologists have warned this groundwater will only last a few years. So next year, the town of Harar hopes to bring a new system online, which will pump groundwater from 30 miles away. It's estimated that water source will last 3 decades at the most. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow in Haramaya, Ethiopia.
Funding for this story was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Meanwhile, in Myanmar, the problem is too much water, not too little. It's monsoon season. Aid groups are struggling to get past government barriers so they can reach people still in desperate need after that devastating cyclone that hit 3 weeks ago. World Vision is one of a small group of aid organizations that already had large numbers of workers, most of them nationals, on the ground in Myanmar before the cyclone hit. So the organization has been able to cut through the military red tape and use its local staff to distribute food and supplies. Tim Costello is the head of World Vision Australia, and he spoke to us from Yangon. He says that the repercussions from this disaster will be felt for years to come.
Not only did this cyclone go 250 kilometers inland over 200,000 square kilometers, unlike the tsunami that only went 3 or 4 kilometers at most inland, it took out the rice basket, which feeds Myanmar.
But what causes him the most concern right now is the rain. It's pouring in Myanmar. The monsoons are arriving.
The rain makes the roads unpassable. The truth is that what is desperately needed here is helicopters and planes, the heavy lifting, fast-moving equipment that gets aid urgently to people.
And the government of Myanmar has not been allowing foreign aid groups to use their own planes.
There are immense challenges, and of course, with more rain, the great threat is the outbreak of cholera. Already we are seeing non-life-threatening but serious outbreaks of malaria, dengue fever, diarrhea, and dysentery. But cholera, of course, is a lethal epidemic, and that is the nightmare scenario if the rains trigger that.
That was Tim Costello, head of World Vision Australia. He spoke with us from Yangon, Myanmar. World Vision is a sponsor of this program. News about the natural disasters in Myanmar and China have occupied the headlines in the last few weeks. It's easy to take such news coverage for granted. But behind every news story, whether it's from a war zone or a natural disaster, there's a reporter who's there and who brings it to us. Kevin Seitz is a journalist who spent his career reporting on war and conflict. 2 years ago, Kevin joined Yahoo and set out on a year-long quest. His goal? To cover every major global conflict in the world over the course of a year. The story of what happened over that year is chronicled in his new book. He was hoping to educate his audience, but in the process, he realized he had some things to learn as well.
I went through an interesting transformation in this process. I had covered conflict for 5 years before I even started this project. But I think I was also one of those people that really had a misperception of what war was about. I really defined war as combat, when in reality, the combat is really just a small portion. We should define war as collateral damage, because that is the dominating theme that you see in all these conflicts. When I started reporting it, you know, I wasn't showing the full spectrum of their lives. And part of that spectrum is laughter. Part of it is anger, bitterness, resilience, and all of those things needed to be a part of the story.
You've been to how many countries? More than 20 in a year, right?
It was more than 20 different conflict zones. Some of those were hot, some of them, within different situations, peacekeeping operations going on and so on.
I'm thinking in particular about the women you wrote about in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You were doing a story, I think, about the victims of sexual violence. But in your piece, you write about their broad smiles and laughter, which is not what we would expect. What was it you wanted your reader to know about these women?
It was amazing to me that despite all they suffered, they were able to somehow transform those acts of hatred. Many of them became pregnant with children from these rapes. And I remember one woman in particular named Barwana, who named her child Binja, which means goodness. And she, in a sense for me, transformed that act of hatred, you know, into an act of love. And it really compelled me to want to tell these stories and make sure that they were being heard because they were trusting me with their words.
You write that it was tough for you to leave the women when you finished your reporting assignment, and I'm sure it was tough for you to leave a lot of these people you became connected to. You said with the women in Congo, you wanted to protect them, and you even fantasized about turning their predators into prey.
Exactly.
How were you able to detach yourself as a journalist from the people whose lives you had become a part of?
Well, I couldn't completely, you know, and to be quite honest, I haven't. But there are cases like the one in which you just mentioned where I am getting in a vehicle and I'm leaving those women in the late afternoon. And I know that evening, again, men will probably be coming down from the mountains, you know, with torches and guns and doing what they do there nightly, you know, preying on them and assaulting them. And it was very difficult for me to accept that I could possibly leave and allow this to happen, just the way it was difficult to accept that I would have to leave without giving someone any food. I didn't have any food. But I had to realize what my role was there. And my role was to tell their stories, you know, to make sure that the power of their words was being heard by people. And that's the one thing I can actually give them.
Many of the stories out of Africa are filled with intense suffering and poverty. In fact, some even call the coverage out of their poverty porn.
Right, exactly.
And I understand how reporters, when they see and experience these things, want to convey the emotion to the listener or the reader. And yet it often causes the listener or reader to shut down. It doesn't do the very thing the reporter's trying to do, which is to draw the reader into that situation. How did you avoid that trap?
I'm not sure I did. I mean, there were many occasions where I got responses from viewers on the website that said, you're paralyzing us. You know, we don't know what to do. I mean, these are powerful stories, but at the same time, once you read them, you don't have any idea of what to do. And I realized at that moment that what I was doing was I was dehumanizing those people through their misery. You know, again, showing only that aspect of their lives where there are lots of dimensions. You know, I've seen so much, you know, tragedy and suffering in the world, but also so many people that overcome it every single day. That, you know, the important thing about that, though, Peggy, is that that kind of resilience doesn't absolve us of our responsibilities to those people. It means we should work that much harder.
I'd like to take us a little closer to home in Haiti, which the UN has named the most corrupt country in the world, and I know you've spent quite a lot of time there. You wrote quite a poignant story about a pregnant fisherman's wife and her three children who live in the slum. What is it you wanted your readers to learn about Haiti from her story?
We went there with lots of warnings. This is a very violent place. You need to be very careful. You need to have some protection and so on. But what I was struck by was just the sheer poverty of it all. I mean, I literally, on driving in, saw a young girl in the middle of this sea of garbage. It was 5 football fields wide and long, and I could barely see her little black body in the middle of all this white rubbish, and she was using it as her bathroom, and she was living in the midst of all this trash. And the fisherman's wife that I met there struck me so greatly because she was literally living in a corrugated tin shack, and they literally had nothing, and they were experiencing quite a bit of hardship that particular week because the fisherman had a hole in his net. And it hadn't been repaired, and so they couldn't eat. Literally, their sustenance was connected to what they could catch that day. And she had 3 children. All of them look extremely malnourished. And then she had another child on the way.
And yet you say she refused to despair.
She didn't. She still had hope, which is amazing. Some of it had to do with religion and faith. She believed that God was going to make things better for her, that this kind of life couldn't continue. And it was really remarkable to me, because I would have despaired in similar circumstances. I don't know. I couldn't have lived that way.
And when you got back to the United States after being in all these very troubled hot spots, was the fact that you could tell their stories enough for you?
I know when I came back, I was a much angrier individual than I am now. You know, there's been some catharsis in writing this book. You know, there's been some catharsis in talking about it and trying to make people aware. And I just remember I was having a difficult time with my relationships with family members, and I didn't really want to talk to a lot of people. But I also had to realize that it wasn't, you know, necessarily my pain. You know, I was experiencing the stress of other people's misery. That post-traumatic stress, though, is a very real factor, I think, for everyone that sees conflict, for the soldiers and combatants that have to pull the trigger and kill a little piece of their humanity every time they do that, and for witnesses like myself, who in some cases are plagued by their own moral decisions in the field. You know, there was a decision where, you know, I walked past an Iraqi man that was bleeding to death and to continue doing my job. And even though he was going to be dying shortly, I mean, he was still breathing at the moment that I walked past him. And yet I did nothing for him. And, you know, that's a decision I have to live with for the rest of my life. You know, and I think about it a lot. And in some ways, I still feel like I've abandoned the people that helped me, you know, on the road during that hot zone journey. And I want to make sure that I don't do that.
All right. Kevin Seitz, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy. Appreciate all the time.
Kevin Seitz is a journalist and author of the book In the Hot Zone, One Man, One Year, 20 Wars. He joined us from Los Angeles. Chinese officials say the earthquake there will have no effect on the Olympic Games in August. That's good news for all the athletes who've been preparing for the Games for the last 4 years. Peter Westbrook is one of them. He's one of the most decorated fencers in U.S. history. Peter's a 5-time Olympian, a bronze medalist, and he's won the National Saber Championships 13 times. From New York City, reporter Michael Cavanaugh explains how Peter Westbrook inspires thousands of young adults while literally changing the face of fencing.
Now it's a little more complicated now. If he attacks regular, bang, bang, I got to parry. Well, you just might go like this, and then attack me regular, bang, bang.
Peter Westbrook talks fast. He's all nerves and energy.
Never mind. Bang, 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 bang. Bang, bang. You got to parry, when to make it knees, but when to attack.
The hyperactivity that made him one of the greatest fencers in United States history now helps him run a nonprofit foundation. Its goal, to help teach fencing to the hundreds of kids who flood his gym every day. Tonight, dozens of teens and 20-somethings trade blows in gray fencing outfits and wire masks. Most are from New York's toughest neighborhoods, and on a night like this, you'd expect them to be out having fun. But instead, they're here, hanging out with a 55-year-old man.
These are the kids in our after-school program. 35, 40 kids in the after-school program. Tonight is a big night for my discipline, which is saber.
Sabers are the thickest, heaviest of fencing swords. Westbrook walks around his gym in downtown Manhattan, saber in hand. In the background, electronic judging equipment constantly buzzes. He laughs, gives advice, and pokes fun at his students, who always return the favor.
Come on, Pete, come on. Come on, Pete.
Fence, take a look at that.
Westbrook's verbal and physical parries got him into trouble growing up in Newark, New Jersey. Then his mother decided he could use his fighting skills for something more constructive, and she enrolled him in a fencing class. Soon, Westbrook went from being a street fighter to a full scholarship athlete at New York University, and eventually to the Olympic Games.
The sport saved my life. It transformed my life. Without fencing, I don't even know where I'd be, probably nowhere. So I said, you know what? I want to do the same thing for other kids like me. And that's why I did it, and it's working.
For years, he was one of the few black Americans in the sport. But Westbrook is changing that. In 1999, he started the Peter Westbrook Foundation. It offers fencing lessons to kids from poor communities. Thousands of young people have gone through the program, including Akhenaten Spencer L. Westbrook says Spencer L. is a 2-time national champion.
When they said it couldn't have been done, when they said, how are you going to get Olympians out of these big-haired, snotty-nosed inner-city kids? I said, I could do it. And here's my first Olympian.
Spencer L. grew up in Harlem. The 27-year-old is big, muscular, and as soft-spoken as Peter is wiry and gregarious. Before fencing, Spencer L. cared more about being cool than being successful.
A lot of obstacles I overcame, you know, in school and being in special education, and people didn't really think that I had an interest in anything.
And now he's training for the Beijing Olympics.
You know, I walk through the streets of Harlem, and, you know, to everybody else, I'm just another guy, you know, and that's cool with me. When I come here, I'm something more. You know, I'm not just a guy from Harlem. I'm a fencer, I'm an Olympian, you know, I'm a mentor.
Westbrook is very aware that most of the young people who come through his doors won't end up at the Olympics. But that's not the only goal of his foundation.
They get a lot out of it. We have a tutoring program for them, a mentoring program. Last year, we spent $70,000 on a tutorial program. We have essay contests, writing, where we give out money for essay contests bi-monthly. We have guest lecturers come in and speak to them about career path. People give these kids intern positions, paid positions during the summer times. We help pay for their SAT preparatory courses. We help them to get in private high school scholarships for free. Fence.
19-year-old Kanate Primus explains why Westbrook is such an inspiration.
That's one of my father figures right there, man. I got so much respect for Peter, and it goes both ways because he has so much respect for me.
Fence.
Westbrook referees while two of his students clash sabers.
He takes your blade after you parry. If I were you, I'd cut someplace else. 5-2, ready? Fence.
As the night goes on, Westbrook seems to talk even faster, like he doesn't have time to waste. He's training fencers for the national championships. He's got hundreds of kids in his weekend program, and a capital campaign for his foundation is in full swing. And tonight, it's already past 9, but a crowd of young fencers still surrounds him. And maybe if he talks fast enough, he can help them all.
Forget about winning. Forget about if you lose the belt. Don't worry about losing the belt. Come up with a new tactic with him. 11-4, ready?
For the World Vision Report, I'm Michael Cavan in New York City.
Tactic, you took the blade, but you landed on the ball. 12-4, ready? Fat.
A long, drawn-out war in Cambodia in the 1970s left thousands of people disabled from landmine injuries or untreated infections. Life for these amputees can be lonely. Women amputees find it especially hard in this culture, where female beauty is highly valued. Megan Williams brings us the story of one woman who's defied all expectations.
45-year-old Sereen Nguyen climbs up the ladder of her front veranda as chickens peck at the ground below. This traditional house on stilts serves both as her home and a tiny shop where she ekes out a living. The little bags of rice, candies, and salt that she sells are strung along her veranda rail. As Nguyen's young nieces and nephews play nearby, she points to the corner where she cooks her evening meal, then to the mat beyond a door where she sleeps. Gingerly, she tucks her legs beside her and settles onto the wooden floor, her sun-weathered face cracking into a shy smile. Nguyen's right leg tapers off into a shriveled curl, and her right hand is rigid with paralysis. Without crutches or a wheelchair, she moves across her village on the ground, with one hand in a rubber thong and the other lifting her paralyzed leg so it won't drag. At the age of 5, Nguyen came down with polio. She says the toughest part of her life has been the isolation. As she explained to a translator, Nguyen says the worst years occurred during the brutal Pol Pot regime, when many disabled people were murdered.
During the Pol Pot years, I did nothing. When I did go out, my father used to pull me around on an ox cart. But for most of the time, I was inside doing nothing.
But the isolation continues to this day.
When people see me, they usually ignore me. Even those people who don't think bad things about disabled people, they often won't look at me or talk to me.
But Nguyen has another life. In it, she's one of the fastest women in Cambodia. Nguyen wheels across the gravel path of a community center in a sleek red three-wheel racing chair. 4 times a week, she hitches a ride on the back of a moped to the central Cambodian town of Kampong Chang. Here, she trains as a wheelchair athlete. Today, Coach Giam Sipana counts out as he takes Nguyen and her 4 teammates through stretches and sit-ups in the yard of the community center. 2 years ago, a local sports group launched the country's first ever wheelchair racing team. Its goal is to help empower disabled Cambodians through athletics. The group gives the athletes special racing wheelchairs and a stipend of about $30 a month to train. It's an initiative with particular importance for women. There is a National Amputee Volleyball League, but disabled women need another option when it comes to sports. Founder Christopher Minko, who's from Australia, explains.
Women are simply just uncomfortable from a cultural and a cosmetic viewpoint of standing up. Women with a disability, particularly amputees.
With wheelchair racing, Minko says, the women don't feel like they're on display. They can build upper body strength, but just as important, have contact with the world outside their villages. The quiet grip and push forward of hands on wheels. In today's afternoon heat, Nguyen is doing short distance training, a series of 400 meter dashes. After the session, the group winds down with more stretching. Nguyen's chest is still rising and falling from the sprints. As she rubs her arms, she says that while she feels a lot better overall, the workouts are still a challenge.
But it wasn't too daunting. The only thing is that sometimes my arms are very sore after.
Back at her village, Nguyen's family and neighbors gather around her veranda. They're excited about the change in her since she began racing. Nguyen's older sister, Kha Vien, says that Nguyen is a different person.
She goes everywhere. She's earning money. She's finally happy.
Nguyen also keeps repeating that same word to describe her life now.
Happy. I get out into the world. I'm part of society. Before I became an athlete, I was stuck in the village. I had aches and pains. Now, I'm happy.
I ask the women gathered round if Nguyen has changed their ideas of what disabled women can do. They say yes, that before they hadn't thought it possible that a woman without the use of a leg could become an athlete. Then I ask them if they too would like to take up a sport. They have too much to do, they say, with work in the fields and taking care of children. So for now, it's Nguyen who's their trailblazer. For the World Vision Report, I'm Megan Williams in Kampong Chang, Cambodia.
And that brings us to the end of our show for this week. Remember, you can hear this show anytime on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up for a podcast there if you'd like to take us with you. Our radio team includes Mark Bandy, Chris Baldiga, Cynthia Graber, Sue Shepherd, and I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Join us again next week for another edition of the World Vision Report.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.